Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching David Gordon Green's 2000 film, George Washington.
Yeah, we did. Let's do a synopsis to start.
Yeah.
Would you like to do the synopsis?
Yeah, happily. So, it's an interesting film that kind of works as a bit more of a mood and tone piece than a straight kind of forward narrative, but it tells the story of a group of four friends who are in a low-income area of the South in America, kind of over the summer, their friendship and things, and a tragedy that happens amongst them, with one of the kids unfortunately dying, and how that kind of affects the other three and their kind of the rest of their lives unfolding, I guess. Very brief, but yeah, quick kind of summation, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's only one point, plot point to the story.
As I said, it's an interesting film in the sense that there's not necessarily a straightforward narrative structure. It is just a tone and it's a mood piece.
It's one of those films where it's like the in-between moments movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're very rare films where it just focuses on moment to moment. And I think it's one of those movies where some people will love it, and some people will find it tremendously boring.
Yes, and frustrating to watch, yeah. And I think it's also a style of film that is very hard to do well. And I think David Gordon Green has done it exceptionally well with this film, and there are some other cases in his career where it's like, not necessarily as well, but like, he nails it with this one, I think.
Yeah, it's something hard to juggle. Like, you got to be very subtle and quiet about it.
Yeah.
I loved this movie.
Yep.
Because it kind of, if you bring yourself into it, if you allow yourself to get swept up by it, it just gives you so much. I think initially I found the first 20 minutes or so was just a series of moments where I go, I'm not really sure where this is going, and there's just certain points where there's these little fun, quiet, subtle, beautiful moments with the characters and you start to fall in love. The film charms you, and then it just starts throwing you these wonderful things.
Yeah, it's one where, like you said, after the first 20 minutes or half hour or so, you understand what the film is, what it's doing, and how it's constructed, and the moments that get thrown at you from that point on, you get just 100% swept up in, and just it grips you more and more and more, and you learn to love these characters despite knowing very little about them at the same time. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of surreal almost, because
yeah.
I felt that I wasn't connecting wholly with them, but at the same time there was such a depth there that was delivering so well.
Like, the example that's just kind of jumping to my mind, and I know I'm jumping way forward in the film, but this is, like, at around the hour mark or so, there's the scene between Vernon and Sonia sitting, like, in, like, a dump somewhere or something. It's just the two of them and talking about, like, their feelings. And you're just like, oh, yeah, all the feels right now. But, like, you don't really know much about those characters yet. Just for some reason, you're dropped into the middle of this conversation between these two young people who are going through something pretty intense, and you're just like, yep, I know exactly where I am, what's happening, and I am dialed in on this.
Yeah, well, I mean, we should explain that you know, that Buddy, one of their friends, slips on in a bathroom floor and effectively kills himself.
Yeah, I mean, he dies. It's an accident. Yeah,
he cracks his head open.
Yeah.
And so, Vernon, what's the girl's name?
Sonia.
Sonia and George.
Yep.
They decide to keep it all hush hush and try and go on with their lives. And I think it's fascinating how each one of them deals with it.
Yeah.
There's like such a morbidity with the whole premise, and yet it's turned into something quite bittersweet and beautiful. George becomes obsessed with saving lives.
Yes.
Whereas the other two are doing the kind of, I suppose, the normal thing where you kind of fester and freak out and you try and figure out what you're going to do with this fucked up situation.
Bizarrely, you kind of get an entire spectrum of reaction or emotion, I suppose. Like you were saying, George kind of turns and decides to start saving people and doing good in the world. You have Sonya, who is neutral, and she kind of laments the fact that she's broken and doesn't really have emotion.
Mm.
And then you have Vernon, who his kind of arc is he is the one that kind of freaks out the most and is having the hardest time dealing with it, I suppose, and to the point of eventually kind of jumping on a train and leaving at the end.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because that's almost like the characters, especially George and Vernon, kind of do a bit of a swap from where they were, because Vernon at the outset is the very kind of tough, outspoken, brash one, and George is the very meek, quiet dreamer character.
Yeah, the suppressed one, I guess.
Yeah. And they end up, after the incident, it's how this incident affects and twists them, and they end up becoming almost the opposite of who they were to some degree, or at least heighten the elements that they were kind of suppressing earlier.
Mm.
Like, Vernon was suppressing all of his feelings, but once this happens, they just consume him.
Yeah.
And likewise with George.
Yeah.
Super fascinating character pieces.
Yeah.
And then you have poor Sonya just stuck in the middle.
Yeah.
And she, I guess her arc is eventually reconciling and understanding emotion and being able to actually go and tell the police what happened at the very end. But yeah.
I think I'm going to struggle slightly to talk about this film.
Yeah. It's a hard one. Because there is no straight narrative, and it's very simplistic, I think, at the same time as well.
Well, it's deceptively simplistic.
Yes.
Yeah, because...
But that's what makes it
work. There's
a lot
of depth and character there.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those films where you'll watch it, and then it'll stick with you for a little while, and slowly, almost subconsciously, you can unpack it.
Yes.
And try and get the full experience out.
Yeah.
But it does leave you with sort of... some kind of non-satisfaction, I suppose, because the ending is allowed, like, it's not wishy-washy, but it's not wrapping anything up,
no.
Really. My goal for this podcast is to talk at length about the film and then hopefully come to unpack the ending somewhat.
Okay, yeah.
Because there's a whole bunch of interesting editing going on where there's pictures of heroes of the American ages.
Yes.
Indians and presidents and, you know, this,
explorers,
that, and whatever.
Explorers and whatnot, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, a bunch of other more character-related stuff too, but I definitely got the... was left with a what did I just experience,
yes,
kind of moment. So let's hope that we can unpack it slightly.
Hopefully. I would enjoy touching briefly on the older folks that work at the railway.
Yep.
I say older, they're like probably younger than us at that point of making this movie, but like,
yeah,
the guys in their, like, you know, late 20s or whatever that are working at the railway yard, and I guess the contrast of the adults to the kids within the film, I think that'll be something interesting to touch on.
They are young, but at the same time, I think because it's in like a low socioeconomic area,
yeah,
they, even though they're young, they're already very much adults.
Yes.
Realizing that they have to, you know, just work, stay working, you know, that's their life.
Yeah, and I did enjoy, like, early on you kind of pointed out that you have the scene where it's all of the railway workers hanging out having a beer and stuff, and the kids walk up as well, and it's, you pointed out the kind of symmetrical nature of, oh, this is them, like, you know, what they'll eventually grow up to be. It's the idea of, you know, them looking at where their future is heading, I guess, to some degree. And then you've got it's the interesting thing of the incident of Buddy dying. You think that might be the spark of the impetus to, like, thrust these kids into adulthood and having them deal with real life responsibilities and things, but it's not necessarily the case. Like, that seems like the trope that a normal kind of Hollywood movie would do, almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting one. I just, with the railway workers, they seem to be, like, yes, they are adults, and yes, they have jobs and responsibility, but there doesn't seem to be the growth or development that the kids necessarily put on it, I guess, of, like, you know, them being adults.
Mm.
If you can't, it's a clunky way to word it.
Do you mean that the railway workers are adults, but they also have, like, an element of chaotic innocence too?
Yes, yeah. Right. Which is kind of exemplified by, I think his name's Rico, the Paul Schneider character, who, you know, ends up hanging out with the kids and chatting with them and giving them life advice and stuff. It's like, yeah. No, they're just... And he works as a wonderful symmetry because, you know, Buddy's lamenting the fact that Nazia has left him for George and stuff, and he laments a similar story. He's just like a de facto...
He's equally confused. He just happens to be in an adult body.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the thing. It's the what? That's yeah, perfect way of what I was trying to get at earlier. It was clunkily. Yeah, it's the idea of the kids looking at these older people and assuming they've got everything worked out, but it's like no, they're just exactly where you are at the same time. It's this interesting kind of plateau of life.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Why don't we?
And that also, sorry to interrupt, it carries through as well to. The adults, like Uncle Damascus as well, with the dogs. Like, you assume he hates animals and, like, the killing of George's dog and stuff is based on just a, like... No, we, you know, responsibility, can't have a dog, but it's like, no, his fear and anxieties, and it's a very innocent thing that kind of fuels that, and it's like...
It's a childlike irrationality, too.
Yeah, exactly, and it shows that he is not... this all-seeing, all-knowing kind of ruler person. He is as broken as everyone else in the world, and yeah. It's really lovely. That I really enjoy that scene.
Yeah, me too.
It's,
me too.
It's fucking beautiful.
Because he is such a... like he seems so unchanging and just...
aggressive.
Rigid.
And,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But when he's got like all of his sad problems...
too. Exactly. It's just showing, yeah, like I said, this the plateau of humanity of everyone is, like, on an equal playing field and everyone has their troubles and their worries and it's, yeah, just this wonderful little...
And that actor just killed that, man. Like, there's this bit where he's kind of, like, has a trembling lip, he's about to cry, and it's so amazing to watch him be such a fucking almost brutal man to having him tell his story to this young boy.
Yeah.
And then having his lip tremble.
Yeah, just feel like you, me, really, same.
Yeah, it was really, really beautiful. And I think that's the strongest aspect of the film is there's... It kind of makes you think that everything is sad and wasteland, and then there's these beautiful moments in between everything else.
It's just showing humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all this film is just humanity put up on the screen for you for... 89 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And photographed beautifully.
I was super impressed.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Like, it is one of, I think, the better looking films we've kind of seen probably since Cranes Are Flying. It doesn't necessarily use visual language in the same sense, but it's using the camera almost like a paintbrush.
It's very emotive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's using the lighting and shadows and, in particular, colour and contrast of those to kind of elicit emotions and responses from you as an audience, and it just fucking nails it.
Mm. Yeah.
I was kind of semi-saving this for trivia, but fuck it. Roger Ebert absolutely loved this film. He gave it 4 out of 4 stars and said it put it in his top 10 for the year. And he actually highlighted Timothy Orr's cinematography and said that it was the best shot film of 2000. Yeah.
I read that too.
Okay. So not necessarily.
As I said, it's one of those films where I was kind of like, oh, I'm loving this, but I don't really... not really coming to grips with it, so literally I've got to jump on the internet and try and learn about it while I'm watching. But yeah, I mean, he's totally right. It's gorgeous.
Mm. It's a film I think it's pretty obviously heavily inspired by Terrence Malick and some of his early films, and weirdly what he's gone on to do post-2000. In terms of the kind of visuals and the ethereal look, it's very kind of similar to Days of Heaven, I think. But the innocent nature and the voiceover and everything, just it totally different, like, narrative and tone and everything, but it just has this kind of Badlands kind of feel to it, of like the innocence and of teenagers being caught up into something that's bigger than them, I guess, and the innocent narration kind of going through it. Yeah. I know I'm talking about films you haven't seen.
I'm sorry, I haven't seen them.
But it kind of ends up being really similar to later Malick work, like Tree of Life and the stuff that he's been doing lately, which is just pretty much this film where it's like snapshots of life and humanity, and it's you as an audience interpret as you will, kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to see that David Gordon Green was like calling Malick before Malick did Malick in a weird way.
Well, what's David Gordon Green gone on to do since then?
This is an interesting thing that you've brought up. Okay. So after this, he made another little independent kind of romantic drama called All the Real Girls, which is okay. And then he went on to direct Pineapple Express.
Oh, okay.
The Seth Rogen, James Franco movie.
That's a strong departure.
Not necessarily, because that film is one of the best-looking comedies of, like, mainstream Hollywood comedies, I think, for a very long time. It's got his... Somehow he managed to retain his interesting visual style with that film, which is really interesting.
It's not the same cinematographer or anything, is it?
I'll double check. I think it might be. But then his career, it takes an interesting departure from there, which is... just bear with me. I'm going to check the cinematographer first.
Okay.
Yep, same cinematographer.
Okay.
It seems like he's Tim Ora's kind of stuck with him throughout his career. So, post-Pineapple Express, he then went on an interesting spree where he did Your Highness.
Okay.
That Danny McBride, James Franco D&D movie that is pretty fucking awful.
Yeah, it's very average.
Then he did The Sitter with Jonah Hill and Sam Rockwell. That...
I don't even know what that is.
That's pretty bad. And then he did Prince Avalanche, which is a movie I actually really like. It stars Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch. And it's about, it's set in, like, the late 70s, and it's guys tarmacking a road over a summer.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, and it's, Emile Hirsch plays, like, Paul Rudd's brother-in-law, and he's, like, gotten him the job because he's kind of a fuck-up, and it's just the two of them out. It's this really wonderful little character piece, and I kind of like that.
Fascinating that he would go from this to... being a kind of Hollywood, you know, do what you're told fella.
Yeah, and he's kind of, and from that he kind of goes, he also did an interesting movie with Nicolas Cage called Joe, which I didn't mind. Then he did one with Al Pacino called Manglehorn, which I haven't seen, but apparently is super weird. And then he did a movie with, like, Sandra Bullock. He goes, like, super mainstream or super arty. It's really a bizarre...
But is it like he's trying to... He's trying to make films that will make him money and so that he can do some artistic thing? Or is he just kind of shifted into the... gone from this kind of level of artistry to oh, I'm just going to make, like, some really kind of... some comedies because I feel like doing it and they're not going to be that great, but whatever.
I guess the,
it's hard to put the finger down on it.
I didn't know this was the case, but, it turns out he's now going to direct the Halloween remake.
Okay.
I knew that Danny McBride and Jodie Hill, like, their production company, had been tapped and had bought the rights and are doing the Halloween remake because they're huge genre fans, and they've gotten David Gordon Green to direct it. So that will be... that'll be interesting.
Yeah, well, but I don't know what to say because he's all over the fucking place.
He really is. It's an interesting filmmaker. It's
dipping his fingers in so many pies.
Yeah, which I suppose is admirable, the idea of, like, well, I'm going to be a filmmaker, I will make all spectrums of films, I guess, but,
Yeah, but, yeah, I mean, I don't want to put him down, but, you know, wouldn't you want to hone... if you're an artist trying to make something like what we've just seen...
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want to be honing...
that artistic,
like, your craft,
skill, yeah.
So you don't just go from this to that, to this to that, to this to that.
To, like, yeah, very mainstream, kind of bizarre... comedies, like, you know, dick and fart joke comedies too.
Yeah.
Really wonderful mood tone pieces like this. It's an interesting trajectory.
Yeah. But I don't want to put him down. I mean,
No. Because he made
this work, yes. Like, tremendously.
I enjoy Pineapple Express.
Yeah, me too.
You know, he but I yeah,
Your Highness and stuff is, like, fucking
pretty bad.
Anyway, let's just put that
that's a fun aside, but it's an interesting analysis of seeing a filmmaker go to, like, that's where he's ended up, I guess. That's interesting, I think.
Yes. We'll see what happens later.
Yeah. The other kind of thing we were thinking about bringing up for this episode was teen movies.
Or the kind of coming of age?
Yeah.
Film subgenre?
Because this is very much a film about, like, the snapshot life of these kind of 12, 13-year-old kids and, you know, this event and things and how that shapes them and presenting their world and their existence to us. And I guess whether we kind of compare or contrast it to other films that, I guess, try and
do a similar thing. Yeah, well, I mean, what comes to mind, as you mentioned when we were watching it, is Stand By Me. Similar childlike innocence presented, the children are presented with some kind of morbidity.
Yep.
I mean, it's the same thing, pretty much. It's like a dead body, right? Yep. And how do you deal... Well, Stand By Me is not really that, it still has the same innocence versus...
It's a little bit more innocent... No, actually, no, I take that back. I think it's very similar to this one in the sense that it frames children around, like, you know, it's the same age bracket as well, which helps. But it's framing kids in the same light as adults in terms of the emotional problems they're going through, the realities that they're having to face and everything. It's does the same thing as this film where it's like everyone is on an equal playing field. It's irrespective of age and everything, which I think both of those films do exceptionally well, and that's the kind of why it's one that early on jumps to mind. And probably the train tracks. That probably helps.
It's a trope now.
Yeah, teen films and train tracks.
Yeah.
I suppose, like, yeah, you mentioned as well, the other one is Kings of Summer, the Jordan Vogt Roberts film from a couple of years ago, which, if you haven't seen it, please fucking watch that movie. I think it's one of the most underrated films to come out in the last decade.
Excellent.
So fucking good, and nobody really saw it. It's wonderful.
Anyway, we're getting a little bit...
We're very sidetracked. But, like, that's fine. We kind of figured that would probably happen with this one, since it's so hard to nail down, and it's not much happens in the film.
No. No, but do we want to? I mean, we brought up Stand By Me. We brought up coming of age films. Is there anything to? I mean, we haven't actually said anything.
Yeah,
remotely useful.
No.
In terms of comparison, is it? Do we just put it down as this is one of those kinds of films? If you know.
Yeah,
enjoy that kind of film. I've never met anybody that doesn't like Stand By Me.
Yeah, I would say this is a more artistic version of Stand By Me. This is Stand By Me if it was directed by Terrence Malick, I suppose, is the best way to explain it.
Was that movie? We saw it at the cinemas, and some people walked out, and it was a New Orleans...
Oh, Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, that's a good comparison, I suppose.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Only, well, I mean, it kind of shares the same...
Yeah, but that one's been injected with a shit ton of magical realism in there as well.
Yeah.
And the kind of... Yeah. Fantasy world she's creating.
That's another good film.
Yeah.
That you guys can watch, but we fucking failed to talk about this film
for the
last 10 minutes.
We can bring it back. Okay. I suppose, like, yeah, drawing it back to this, what separates this and I think anchors it in terms of a somewhat structure is the voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of through line that you get, and it's an interesting thing that it's not one of the four kids. So the perspective we're getting multiple perspectives in this film in the sense that we're presented the four kids, yet the voiceover is from someone who's tangentially connected to these four kids, looking back, discussing them in the past tense as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of... Yeah, there's multiple kind of view on these four characters and their relationships.
What's her name?
Nazia.
Nazia.
Yeah.
So the ex-girlfriend of Buddy?
And
the deceased.
Who has a crush on George.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, it's a great touch. There's a whole bunch of little moments in the film where you see her popping her head around a corner, staring at George.
Yeah.
I mean, and she's obviously, like, enamored by him. I mean, to a large degree, pretty much everyone is, all the adults. The uncle, obviously, was touched by what he was doing.
Yeah.
Trying to save lives, but, Yeah, I mean, she narrates very much at the beginning, and I loved that every once in a while you see her head poking around a corner and just watching things. So yeah, she's very much like the fly on the wall, just as we are watching the film.
Mm. And it's almost like she's painting this picture and telling the story from the little moments she's gleaned from, yeah, being kind of off in the distance and stuff, which I suppose helps with the kind of snapshot nature of the film. Like, it's just little parts, pieces here and there, because that's all she's really seen, I suppose.
Man, imagine the movie without the narration. Like,
it'd be real...
You would not know what to do. Like, but they wouldn't have much direction. I mean, it doesn't give you much direction to begin with.
But that's what's interesting. The narration doesn't nail down anything, really. It's just this wonderful kind of guiding voice, kind of taking you through these moments.
It gives you enough.
It gives you enough,
there's
this, but it's
there's
not...
There's one moment where she mentions that George... something like George always was going to be great.
Yeah.
And you don't know about... This is right at the beginning. You don't know that Buddy's going to die. You don't know that any of these kids are going to have to deal with this situation. So you always have... If there was an act structure, you always have... some kind of inkling of what the third act would be like.
Yeah, yeah. The growth of the
George
development
is the
of
one
your
to watch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it, the narration brings something to follow.
Yeah.
Where otherwise you would be watching a series of vignettes.
And just, you know, spliced together through beautiful imagery and things and just silent patches of landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to get to the bottom of the ending, though.
Oh, yeah, no, you mentioned, yeah, trying to decipher that. Do you have a take on it at this point?
Well, if we run through... I think what's interesting is it becomes very... The imagery becomes slightly abstract. You have Vernon jumping on a train, and then there's this overlay of redness everywhere. Do you know what I mean? There's shit like that starts to happen, where it didn't happen prior in the film.
Yeah.
Then you get images of presidents, and you get images of Indians, which I don't know who they are, but I assume that they are kind of heroes to some degree.
And you get Nausea reiterating the opening. It's more or less the same voiceover as the film opened with, talking about George is going to go on and do great things and blah, blah, blah. It's kind of... Acting is a bit of a coda, like, you know, we end where we begin to some degree. But I kind of interpret the images that are presented in conjunction with that voiceover, I kind of helping hammer home the point of these are the people that have gone on to do great things, these just everyday normal people, and the people that George himself looks up to and name checks as well.
Mm.
And then we are presented this weird little black and white scene of George posing for a photograph that looks very presidential. He's got like the flag and he's in a suit and things, and he gets his photo taken. And then he just picks up a milkshake and looks directly into the camera. And I think, like, to me, I interpret that as, like, he will go on to do great things. Or at least that's his perception and other people's perception of who and what he is.
So is that his fantasy?
Yeah. But for now, he's still just a kid.
Yeah.
Hence the milkshake. It's, yeah.
But then the last words that are mentioned in... Within the story, I suppose, is George rocks up to the train yard, and he mentions that all of his friends were killed in a train accident.
Yeah.
And then everyone, all the railway workers are just like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
So, what do you think that he meant by all my friends were killed in a train wreck? Because they weren't killed in a train wreck. And he's obviously... onto something there.
Yeah.
His mind is dwelling on something, which is important.
I suppose, like, you know, the immediate interpretation of train wreck is it's like accident and, like, you know, clusterfuck, I guess. Like, so we could, you know, be interpreting, like...
It's not literal.
Yeah, it's not a literal train wreck. It's the metaphorical train wreck of their existence and their life and their where they are.
Just living in general, right.
Yeah. They've all died because of this train wreck that we are all in this shitty, low socio-economical town. And
so that's why he's wearing a cape, that's why he's wearing
and that's
wrestling
why
outfit.
And that's why he's trying to save people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really wonderful and kind of uplifting in he could be clinically insane. We don't know.
I think it's
a clear response to the accidental death of Buddy.
I think it's beautiful that to him, heroism is lives in innocence.
Yes.
It lives within the confines of innocence.
Mm.
And so to take his character and then show images of all of the great heroes of American American civilization, if you want.
Yeah.
It attaches innocence to those people too. Like, heroism comes from an innocence within.
And it also works to attach greatness to George as well.
Yeah.
At the same time.
It's such a wonderful experience to have such a small film with deep but very isolated characters.
Yeah.
To have such a wonderfully strong, broad message.
Yeah, no, agreed. I thoroughly enjoyed this film, and the message, and it gives you all the feels.
Yeah.
But just something so simplistic.
If you let it.
And yeah.
If you let it.
This is very much a film you could easily put up your fucking walls and just be like, nah.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I'm not willing to kind of let this in, but if you just kind of get absorbed by it, it's fucking wonderful.
Exactly.
Mm. Well, like, we keep referring to it as a little film. I'm kind of slowly moving into trivia at this point. Because that was a nice kind of way to wrap up discussion, I think.
Okay.
Unless you had anything else.
No.
We keep saying it's a little film. If you had to guess the budget, what would you... Unless you already saw it.
Dude, I don't fucking know. Like, alright, I'm going to say $25 million.
$42,000.
What?
Yeah. This movie was made for $42,000.
Well, I should explain my $25 million number then?
Possibly, but... Yeah, this is like a super, super, super independent film.
How did he get that
He went around... it was, film school. He went to film school and things and, like, got people to help out with making that. And he'd made a few short films that he used to show people, like, hey, I have talent, I can make something, and then managed to raise enough funds through, local investors and things to make this film, and, kind of, it went from there.
Well, I mean, there's no...
It's great.
There's no actors that are...
The interesting one is Paul Schneider, who then had acted in the previous short films and everything, so they were old friends. Paul Schneider has now gone on to, like, post... this film, and he also starred in All the Real Girls, David Gordon Green's next film. After that, he went on to star in, like, Lars and the Real Girl, the Ryan Gosling blow-up doll movie, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Assassination of Jesse James by a ridiculously long title. and then, of course, he's Mark Brandana Quits in the first two seasons of Parks and Rec, where he's awful. He's the worst thing about that show. And it's great that he left after two seasons. he's gone on to be, like, a big, Hollywood star and stuff now. Other than that, it was just $42,000. All the actors were just local kids, non-professional actors, and it just helped kind of encapsulate that realism, I guess, that they have.
I'd like to see more of that. It's so nice to just have... real people try and act, and then just happen to choose the right ones.
Yeah, exactly. And they just... the ones that have, like, no self-consciousness, I guess. Like, the idea of a camera being on them being something where they'll kind of clam up, I guess. They're just like, oh, whatever. I'll just fucking talk.
Yeah, very natural.
Mm. But the film then went on to do, like, the kind of festival circuit and hit massive acclaim, like, Ebert giving it 4 out of 4 and things, and then Janus Films Criterion kind of picked it up for its distribution, and that's why it's out Criterion. They bought the rights to it, so yeah. I guess that'd be a good segue to go on to the rest of the trivia and list kind of the usual awards and whatnot that I do. Yeah, so I suppose the main kind of awards that it got recognized for, it got nominated for Best Feature at the Independent Spirit Awards in 2001. It was also nominated for Best Debut Performance at the Spirit Awards, and that award was given to all 5 of the main kids. They all got a joint nomination for Best Debut Performance.
Cool.
It also received Best First Screenplay and Best Cinematography Award nominations at that festival. That's really about it for on the awards front. And bizarrely, there wasn't a whole lot of trivia on this one, just because based on its kind of low budget and unique production. So,
do you have a how much money it made?
Yeah, $290,000 theatrically. It didn't have a massive theatrical run. It kind of did festival circuits and then, like, I think one or two art house cinemas in, like, Austin, LA, New York, kind of just the really boutique things. So weirdly, IMDb...
profitable.
Yeah, yeah. Weirdly, IMDb lists a piece of trivia as did not have a theatrical release in Australia.
Yeah.
Which is...
I'm not surprised.
Not surprised.
I am not surprised at all.
Like, I feel this... nowadays it would.
Yeah.
Given that we actually have a few really nice... at least in Melbourne, we've got some nice art house cinemas now that pick up... if it was nominated for Best Feature at the Independent Spirit Awards, it will probably have a theatrical run in Australia now.
Yeah.
Which is good to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, other than that, there was not a great deal of trivia. I suppose, actually, there was the one you wanted me to point out where I showed Tom in the end credits that the assistant second unit director on the film is Danny McBride.
The Danny McBride.
The Danny McBride, star of Alien Covenant. he also kind of was from the South and went to film school and stuff with these guys, and kind of that's how he got involved with them. Yeah. And kind of helped start his career to some degree as well, because... what was it, 4 years after this was when they made Foot Fist Way, which is incredible. Their little indie film about a taekwondo instructor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How did you happen to see his name in the credits just by happenstance, or...
No, I hadn't. I knew he'd worked on this film as like a behind-the-scenes thing, and then you went out to go grab a smoke after we were watching it, and the credits were rolling, and I was like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Like, I remember now. Yeah.
That's cool.
So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. So the film is actually no longer in print as a one-disc DVD. It's only available as a dual-format Blu-ray and DVD combo. It's one of the few ones where Criterion did that. But it comes with the special features of an audio commentary by director David Gordon Green, cinematographer Tim Orr and actor Paul Schneider, deleted scene with commentary by Green, Orr and Schneider, two student films by Green, Pleasant Grove from 1997 with commentary, by Green, Orr and Schneider, as well as Physical Pinball from 1998, a Charlie Rose interview with Green from 2001, interviews with members of the cast from a 2001 reunion, Klug Gala's 1969 short film A Day with the Boys, which influenced the making of George Washington, as well
That's
as
cool.
Yeah, as well as a trailer and booklet and essays that Criterion always do.
Right on.
Yeah.
It's all right.
It's not a bad addition. But
which you own.
Yeah, yeah.
You got it, mate.
It's one of my old DVDs. I bought this one back when I was in film school. It was fun.
I think, this is... it's a little bit of a gem, man.
Ooh.
I think, you know what's really nice is... I like that a film of this caliber can be made with so little money.
Yeah.
It's like a
and
real...
receive as good a recognition as it deserves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a nice little inspiration point.
Yeah, I had not seen it in a very, very long time, so I was happy to revisit and get swept up in it all over
well,
again.
You have to.
I know.
Because we're up to that.
Yes, this is true. Actually, I think Claire pulled it out and was like, let's watch this. And I'm like, no, we've got the podcast on that soon.
She chose this one. Why did she choose this one?
I don't know. She just, like, I guess, saw...
I like George Washington.
I white, was just like, what
man.
Is this? Yeah.
All right, cool.
It's an interesting, striking artwork. But
Yeah. But
yeah, I guess that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode. If you have any comments or queries or anything, please hit us up on Twitter at CriterionQuest or send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com. And I actually finally got around to starting a Facebook page for the podcast that I'll be posting on periodically. So yeah, just look up Criterion Quest and you'll find us there. But yeah, that'll wrap us up for this week's episode looking at the 2000 film George Washington. We'll be back in a fortnight's time looking at the film General Idi Amin Dada.
What?
It's a documentary about Idi Amin, the ruthless dictator.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. I have not seen this. It's a Barrett Schroeder documentary, so I'm intrigued. So, yeah.
Sounds heavy. Like, that's good. That's fun. Yeah.
So I guess I'd tune in for that. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.